the saxophone first. It has been suggested that from time to time a deliberate error is being introduced into your talks, and that the discovery of this error by the group or any member of the group is then an indication to you of the readiness, of their readiness, for more advanced ideas. Is there any truth in this suggestion? Well, if we remember that when Gautama was asked if he had kept anything back, he said he wasn't a man with a closed fist. And when Christ himself said something to his disciples about them receiving something that people in general could not receive, there was an implied esoteric teaching in both cases. In Gautama's case, he denied that he himself had held anything back. In Christ's case, he said he had held something back. But in neither of those cases was there a statement that deliberate errors had been introduced in order to obviously test somebody's ability to detect errors. The suggestion here is that somebody has suggested that deliberate errors occur, which means that somebody may have detected an error. There was a thinker in the 19th century who said it is every man's duty either to teach or to be taught by every other man. If somebody did detect an error, it would be their human duty to me to tell me of the nature of the error to save me from continuing in that error if there were one. Now, the only way that this could have arisen to my mind is from possibly from two instances that I can think of where sense of humour on one occasion got the better of me, and a friend of mine with whom I've been discussing earlier about the fairy tale of the princess and the pea was terribly amused because we made a joke about the princess being so sensitive that she couldn't even feel a pea through the seven eye down. Now this obviously was an inversion, it was so very sensitive she shouldn't have been able to feel the pea through the seven eyelids. I'm afraid that sense of humour tends to run away with things like that, and I wouldn't call that a deliberate error to say that the princess was so sensitive she couldn't feel a pea through the seven eyelids. I should have thought that would have been self-evidently an error sufficient for everybody to detect it immediately, and for it not to be of any great moment in any case. Another one was that a few weeks ago I was discussing with a TV interviewer a project for a possible TV program in which some sketches were to be done, and at certain points in the sketches a deliberate error was going to be introduced into the TV program, but the viewers were to be warned beforehand that a deliberate error was going to be committed and that they had to detect it and then write up and say what they thought it was, and they would receive a magnificent prize or something like that. The illustration I gave was that I might say I will now draw this man's cheekbone and instead draw the line of the jaw. It's slightly ambiguous. Some people might think it's all cheap, as most of it is on TV now, of course. And the promise could have arisen an idea in at least one person's mind that there was a deliberate error in the talks that he didn't hear. Now, it would be fundamentally wrong spiritually. You know what I've defined morals as? Convenient for the rulers. I've defined ethics as what rational men can be expected to do from their reason. But spiritually, that means in the movement towards freedom, it would be fundamentally wrong of any person deliberately to put forward an erroneous idea which could become a basis of action and which may not be detected by large numbers of people and which might result in them getting into trouble with themselves. I've seen it enough in mental hospitals for many years, since about 1932, of people suffering from erroneous ideas that have been acquired in odd moments in conversations. I've seen some suicides who have become suicides only through erroneous ideas, to know that it would be fundamentally inhuman deliberately to propagate an erroneous idea and use it as a means of somebody showing himself his own level of cleverness in discovery. So I will say now, for any future occasions, if any error is detected in something I say, I personally would like to hear about it, because apart from such mad statements as the princess and the pea, I would not make an erroneous statement knowing that every idea is an energy packet which must make its own associations in the mind, must produce complex ideas, and ultimately, by the feeling tone round it, pass into action and force people into behaviour relations with other beings. I had recently a letter in which a statement was made that I had challenged somebody to do a certain thing. I had not challenged that person at all. I did make a statement that Christ had made a statement that constituted a challenge, but I did not make an individual and personal challenge to the person. It would not be for me to challenge another person to do something at all, because if for a moment that person were to be dominated by the challenge, which could only arise from a cumulative in any case, it would mean that the person would be pushed into action for which he was not yet equipped, and it must necessarily go wrong. So I will state now categorically that no deliberate errors are introduced, that I would consider the introduction of deliberate errors, as I said, not immoral, not unethical, but spiritually utterly unjustified, because it would constitute a definite misdirection, a lead towards false conjugations of ideas, and ultimately to erroneous activity, which could only get that person into trouble and would result later in very, very hard work undoing it. One of the things we know about this is, in doing this kind of work, other people's eyes are on us. The cumulative, as we've defined it before, is so strong that if any man in a group of this size starts to do certain things, the cue elements in himself and in every other man are waiting to knock him down. This we know from the function of the cue elements as defined. So we have to be on guard against this, and I repeat, there is no deliberate error at all, and if any error does creep in, I would like to hear about it. If it's other than the slip of the tongue, I will be surprised, because the stuff that I'm talking about is not individual, and the organism through which it is coming has nothing to do with it. And if it had, I would personally suspect it, because the whole of the work is to destroy this individuality as an interference mechanism. We want to cut out individual interference and to get to the fundamental spirit, which is identical in all beings, the light that lights every man that comes into the world, not that lights a given man and darkens some other man. So if you do spot any errors, let me know about them. They will not be deliberate, and I apologize for the interest in the theme. Now there's another one here. I had a very interesting letter the other day, which is very well thought out. I won't name the fellow, because it is so well thought out that he might be very, very pleased. So I'll promise not to mention it to anybody there. He talked about the different levels of being, and the question has arisen from another source here, out of Bert's question. Is there any yardstick against which an individual wishing to apply special efforts in an attempt to accelerate his development may measure the right or wrongfulness of an act if he is in doubt? Is there a yardstick for handling situations of doubt? Now, the question from Bert, which he thought out very well, was one of levels. We put Q in the middle for this fundamental sexual drive, which appears in the human being, And the human being is a hermaphrodite. He is will, feeling, which is female, and he is counting and intellectual initiative, which is male. Every being has these elements. And they are represented in the circle for the female aspects and the straight line for the intellectual initiative aspects. Every being has this polarity within it. Now, the knowledge level, as we showed, was that Q level where the absolute energy comes in and posits a formal entity as a vehicle for the reproduction of many such entities. And the absolute is working through that energy, and therefore no individual at the Q level can possibly control it. You get this in the statement that no man is continent except God wills it. Continent means containing his energies. Those energies are coming from the absolute. They're just going in, turning around and coming out. You can see immediately that it becomes an impossibility for a finite to hold infinite energy. The infinite prolific comes down, winds itself into an individual, splits itself into the various thermatic individuation forces and presses out. No man can be continent except God wills it. The statement except God wills it means that under certain conditions the absolute will it. But that until for a given being the absolute does will it, it is impossible for a man to contain those energies, to stop leaking. We'll see why as we go along. Now, in Bert's letter, he observed that each of these levels could be considered in the hierarchy as superior to the one below it, and therefore to be positive to it and to determine its activities. He then said that this was like magic working from a higher level onto a lower level. And he made the statement that each level could be defined by the level above as a black magic level. This is correct, isn't it?
Yes.
Now, we have these various levels, and up to the head level, we have the individual evolving under the pressure of absolute forces through the Q or sexual impulses, and then from those to the intellective impulses, from those into the individual power, the headman impulse, and all of those to the individual. Now, if the headman defines the K-man or the Q-man as inferior beings and defines whatever they do below him as black magic relative to his purpose, that is his definition. But the three levels below are individuation levels, but the level above, the E level, the universal level, which is really a soft aspirate, is supra-individual, and therefore it has a universal right to define all those below insofar as they make individual efforts to blow Charlie and be all right, or to get his life out and so on. All those things are defined by the universal as black magics. Now, you remember that we said some considerable time ago that black magic really was lack magic. This question of lacking magic, the bee is the house, you see. Magic is the production of changes in conformity with the will. Black magic means a relative lack of that power to produce changes, and therefore any being below a certain level lacks the magic of the level above it. We will now introduce into this, to be a little more precise, this statement that in order to make magic, the will itself must produce changes in conformity and must make a definition. If there are any beings with the capacity to become aware of their will as a formative force, then we will say they are magical beings. But if there are any beings who are not aware of themselves as will, then they are not mental at all. Now, absolutely, we can say that it's all magical, but because it is all spirit, and spirit is power, and ultimately absolute will. So it is all magical. As we come from the absolute to the universal, the universal is a first order circumscription, and in this first order circumscription we have already a lack. The lack of the three absoluteness. So this A level, the B level, if you use the English alphabet, really consistent about these letters. The E level corresponds with the macrocosmic Christ, who says, I do the will of my Father. It is the universal doing the will of the absolute. The absolute loves the world, so the absolute creates the world. So the first circumscribing, the big macrosphere, is the cosmic body of Christ. And it is responsive to the absolute frequency. And whatever the absolute frequency tries to do, the universal is listening to it, can feel the vibrations on its surface, and works to bring it to be in its interiorization process. So he says, I work, and my Father works. My Father works in secret, I work openly. And notice the strange fact that the secret is outside, it is transcendent. Whereas the openness is on the inside, in the closed. This again is a paradox. Not to do in the day. Now, when this universal is working, it is working to bring all beings to the will of the absolute. But the moment we go down to the headman level, we find the individual striving to feather his own nest regardless of the purpose of the universal or of the absolute. Now, it's at this point, in general, that we refer to black magic and the left-hand power. Remember, Christ sits at the right hand of God the Father. That is to say, he's at the hand of power. That is the absolute. And the power of the absolute comes immediately to the universal. But the universal filters that power, so that when the head level gets it, the H level, the individual power man gets it, it is already second-hand. It has been filtered by the universal. So therefore, no individual can ever gain control of the absolute. This is very important. And why Christ says, no man comes to the Father except through me. No inner circle can get to the infinite without traversing the binding circles that enclose it. So no man comes to the Father, absolute, but by me, cosmic Christ. The word lack now takes on its real importance, because this LK function here, if you've seen the word like, and reversing the word kill, which you don't like, has to do with the tying up and closing of anything whatever. Now, you can see there is no lack in the matter of cosmic. Although there is a lack. Because his determination to agree absolutely with the absolute keeps the universal will in exact phase with the absolute will. So although the Son could not of himself do those things universally, yet because of his absolute agreement with his absolute Father, there is no lack in him. And therefore it says, the Father gives all power into the hands of the Son. So the absolute gives all his power into the hands of the universal Christ. And there is no lack. So although there is a circumscription in bringing into existence the universe, it is not called a lack, although the same function is used, the LK. It is the same as lack or the lick. And you'll notice here a peculiar relation between that lick and the lick, but with a Y, which means wolf. You know, the lycanthropy, the werewolf, which hits the Sunday newspapers periodically, which is based on this LK function. Because when the universal sphere is made, it constitutes a great appetite, which is a wolf, which Shakespeare in Troilus and Cressida calls the universal wolf. because it is like a great mouth. But that mouth is filled with the Absolute. And the energy of the Absolute filling that becomes the successive inner layers within the universe. So we do not really apply the expression lack in the sense of deficiency until we come to the head level. Because it is individuated, and as long as it is struggling as an individuated being for its own individual ends, it necessarily lacks in the sense of being deficient that which the universal could give it if it could bring itself into conformity with the universal. The Hetman now filters the energy from the universal and deliberately keeps a secret from the K-man. The Hetman does not let the K-man know that he is using individual will. Those of us who saw Ross, Lawrence of Arabia last night, and have seen a play about a man who said, "My trouble is I have worshipped an idol, a finite, the will." He had worshipped this. Those who know the history of Lawrence will remember that from a very early stage he was hammering himself through various levels to develop his will for the job he had to do in Arabia. And yet he saw that working for this individual will was not enough, and that he would have to transcend it. To work in this individual manner, he had to beat down the reason in himself which said he couldn't do it. For instance, Lawrence, as a young man at the university, used to go for long walks, and he used to hold his breath and tried to force himself to walk without breathing until he came to the end of his capacity. And the reason said, "You can't do this." And when the reason said, "You can't do it," he did it. He did some more of it until he was exhausted completely. This is the basis of the possibility of his work later. The Hetman suppresses the reason's voice. The individual headmen suppress the reason men, the rationalists, and tell them what they believe to be a lie. They tell them it is a good to be rational. Because if the rationalists knew that headmen do not use their reason, but only their will to power, then many of the rationalists would start trying to be willful. And if there became too many headmen, then there would be confusion. You see, the pyramid depends upon the rule. The higher they go, the fewer. So if we put the bricks in the pyramid and say the headmen are somewhere about, we'll have to finish the pyramid to be accurate, the flat top, and the brick that's not on it, the ghost brick, is the absolute. The top brick is the universal, and below this are a few H-men. Hetman. Now, if all the people below were told that by individual will one can overthrow any system whatever within, there would be a considerable number of attempts made to overthrow it. And confusion would arise, and there'd be lots of bricks coming from below to try to make the pyramid this shape, each one would dash up, and the whole thing would become confused. So the headmen, who only rule by act of will, never admit it. They always pretend that they are rational. Now the rationalist men are very, very fond of being reasonable, and they are very fond of being told by the headmen that it's a very good thing to be reasonable. You may remember that Churchill on one occasion, who allows himself to be printed and titled as a Titan, this another gentleman, which is another headman, and I feed him out of the Old Testament, said, "I don't know any arithmetic. Never was any good at it, but I can always buy one if I want one. An arithmetician." Now this is the whole point about it. The headman can employ a clerk, a caveman, or a mathematician. The men that have actually been employed by the headman to make H-bombs and were led to drop them on Hiroshima and Nagasaki do not themselves admit their position. the rationalists who worked out the mathematics of the bomb and made it possible were pushed around by the H-men who couldn't understand the mathematics of the bomb. But they thought it was tremendously interesting for their purpose. We have found, and we actually have printed, even in a nice popular paper, like the New Scientist, 18 months ago, that you will find an article in which a statement is made by the editor of a very, very responsible science magazine, Nature, one of the best, that scientists, that is, K-men, were now known to be being blind, and that it was no longer true to say that science was committed to truth, and that in all the different countries of the world, scientists would exchange ideas freely in the name of truth. Something more than truth was at stake. Power. The scientists were declared in sufficient numbers to make it uncomfortable to be receiving bribes to distort facts, to conceal information, or because they have now reached a level where they could make very powerful weapons. The H-men, the power men, were utilizing these scientists, these mathematicians, and glorified clerks. And those clerks, doing their mathematics, could not see that they were being utilized by the H-men, but they knew there was something tremendous above them, and a little pat on the head saying, "You make me a bigger bob and I like you. After all, you're terribly clever in your mathematics, and I just don't understand pi to the nth at all. But I do understand what I want, and what I'm going to get. And if you don't get it for me, I shall remove you and find somebody who will." Those removals have occurred. In Italy, they would call it during the war doing a Balmo. Now, this process of dictatorship by the headmen on the rationalists below them is of tremendous importance for the problem we have been set about how do we choose in a situation of doubt about what we shall do. Doubt implies doubleness. It means that there is a choice. Which of two acts shall we choose once we have realized that all levels inside the universal, the H, the K, and the Q level, are inferior to the universal, and each one is inferior to the one above it, and the Q one is the lowest. Supposing Hetman, Mr. Bert Wilson, for instance, is about to launch forth in the field of business. Now, as soon as he begins to consider himself in the field of business, he knows he's up against other headmen. That is, men in the same business, or an allied business. How shall he choose whether he shall foist his wares on the unsuspecting Q-boys, because they are the market? What shall he do about it? Shall he just go ahead, develop himself as an H-boy? Or shall he try to become universal? If he tries to become universal before he has become H, all that will happen to him is that he will fall back into K. Now this is very important. When the Q boy tries to climb above the Q level, it's only because he just received a kick, a very hard one, from the girlfriend. Either she's run away with another boy, or she actually doesn't like this particular one, even if there's got another about. The Q-boy never lets go until he has to. And he constitutes the customer. When a pain comes in sufficiently often, from a sufficient number of signs, then he becomes enlightened by the energy of the stimulus. Now when we say enlightened, we mean that light gets into him and he becomes lighter, less gross. Remember, we're overcoming inertias. There is a Q-inertia. If we add the energy of the painful stimulus, as Kierkegaard would say, let him fall in love with a girl, which gives him ideality of the first yonder, then let the girl let him down by running away with another man, and that will remove the ideality of the first order and place ideality of the second order. He still retain the idea that there is something marvellous in the universe, but he will abandon the idea that it was that particular girl. Kierkegaard thinks that that is the function I'm not saying this, it's not my idea of it. Kierkegaard says it is the function of the woman, and it's the best thing she could do for a man, first to entrance him so that he becomes ideal in her and soars into the stomach field of universal affection, and then to rush away with another man. Whereupon he's left with his high idea and no gross representative. He retains his ideology. That is Kierkegaard's statement. There is something in it. How much is it we'll have to reserve for another occasion? The fact is that only the painful stimulus converts the Q man by enlightening him with the input of energy from the painful situation, which enlightens his consciousness and takes the gross inertia off him a bit, and he then becomes the rational. First of the lowest order, he just thinks that particular girl is no good. And then he climbs very, very high and he thinks most of them are no good. And then he climbs right to the top and says, no, I'm not very good. If he gets into the head level, then he thinks, they're all no good, so I might as well get a good one. Once it has been defined, they're all no good from the point of view of the cue boy, that is to say, the male who is determined only to express that force of the absolute which comes through him to multiply, and that no individual girl likes to be simply the doorway to a non-individuated force. She, at the same level, wants to hang on to the initiating energy. Now the male element doesn't go to the female element in order to go to jail. It goes to enjoy itself. And the female does not allow this entrance other than for her end as an individual. And both of them are subjected to the absolute necessity of reproduction. When he climbs up to the K level, he discovers that all women are women. This is in principle. He doesn't at that level know that all women are men and all men are women. In other words, that the human being is a hermaphrodite. So he gets disappointed by the fact that he can't constrain one of them to be nice to him without her being nasty to him, and he's being nice to another one. He can't get her to reach this universal tolerance in one leap that he feels would be a good thing if he had it. So he climbs up and through progressive pains becomes intellectualized. He then becomes a left winger. Remember, left means the pride. The right hand of God is the universal. And the nearer we go inside, the more left we are. And so we say politically, the left wing is the Q level. You see that sign on bus stops, don't you? It's the sign for those beings that will stand in a line when they see their special symbol. They do this, you know. That's okay. The humorists at the head level who devise these symbols do so with their tongues in their teeth. London Underground means that in this metropolis you're in a hurry. You see, you can't go to the centre without the Now, once this rationalization level is reached, every failure is explained by a rational notion in the mind. And the whole function of this K level is to explain deficiencies. Remember, you become progressively K'd by being negated at the Q level. Every time a sexual attack by a man is repulsed, the energy in him that should have hit the female target interferes. And it goes in the head, and it goes round and round and round, and explains why this failure occurred. It wasn't a failure at all. If it's a wrong girl, the wrong time, or propaganda by another person. It could never be that she didn't like me personally. That isn't a Q function. You can't think that way. Because it's a one energy, a unity energy, pointing in one direction, and he has no doubt in it at all. So when it is blocked, the energy that blocks it causes, quite mechanically, a process called thinking. And this thinking just goes round and round and round inside and explains why that failure occurred, and that it wasn't a failure at all. So the K level is full of excuses for impotence.
So, at your rational level, you will never find anything at all except an excuse for faith. This is why the Buddhists, who were good psychologists, said the mind, and they were referring to this K-level when they used the term, is the organ of fear. All it is concerned with is the fact that it has been defeated and how to dodge it, and how to explain. Now, when a sufficient number of these reasons has piled up and immobilized the being by their self-contradiction, because the essence of the intellect is that it contradicts itself. If you argue with yourself long enough, you will merely pile ideas up for and against the same thing and completely paralyze yourself. You'll be in a state of doubt and of despair. The doubt is your devil, that's the opposition of the ideas. The disparity is between what you want to do and what you can do. When you are then completely blocked, the usual thing to do, of course, is go into a mental hospital and today to receive various types of shock treatments to reduce you back to the Q level. So you are then cured. Now, the cause of this is that the heat generated by the self-contradiction and the self-image of Q as failure produces a very, very great heat in this heart as I am. And when that heat is produced, flash occurs. This is the incandescence again, under this mercurial rotation of the ideas. When the flash occurs, if the fellow speaks, he would probably get locked up. Because he would say, I have just seen a light. And then it would be on TV, and it would be explained to him that that wasn't a light at all. And they'll prove to him with a hammer that it wasn't. If, when the self-contradiction of the intellect is seen for what it is, namely self-contradiction of the intellect, and that the intellect is not all, then suddenly there becomes functionally in consciousness a new level, the eighth level. Let's take an example. I saw on one occasion, I was very pleased to see it, because a very tiny little man threw five policemen about when he suddenly broke down from his K level. He had been a very rational little man, and by overdoing it he had managed to contradict himself to the level of incandescence. And at that moment he spoke in Piccadilly Central and was immediately jumped upon, and 2 seconds on his chest round three more came to aid, and he was tossing them about all over the place, and he was very small. But the eighth function appeared in him at that moment. Now, the priests don't like eighth functions appearing below them. They love it above them, because that gives them a sense of security. They don't like it below them. Most policemen, as you can tell by the second syllable in the word, belong at the Q level. Now, the important thing to see is that when you burst through the intellect into the H level, you are suddenly aware of yourself as an individual will who does not have to be restrained by reason at all. If you then rush about declaring this to people, you are being un-Taoistic. The Tao says, if you do not declare your aim, you cannot be said to fail. If you do declare your aim, say, I have no regard for social structures, then a lot of K-boys will start rationalizing your behavior. And they will start defining you as anti-K, that is to say, as antisocial. And if this comes to the notice of other hetmen, which it will do if they came in and had their way, the other hetman will look at you and will say, there aren't many seats up here. And suddenly you'll be thrown back into the queue level in a special little cell. So when you feel this fact of individual will coming inside you, and you know that you can do something, like make a business or sell a refrigerator or something, over against a wicked rival and humiliate yourself, then you have to say to yourself, I will choose. And I will choose between two ideas. One is, I will sell refrigerators for my sake, and that will put you on the black magic side. And the other is, I will sell refrigerators for a universal sake. And you can actually sell refrigerators for a universal sake. Can be done if you will. Bother to identify with the universal. It has already invented the refrigerators to try to keep the Q level a bit cooler. Now, it's a very simple thing. We said that we won't use the word lack meaning deficient of the universal, but we will use it of the HK and Q level. When you're at the H level, and this is Bert's special question, how do you know what to do when presented with alternatives? The answer is you always say to yourself, I could do this for myself, and I could do it for the universal. If I see the universal purpose behind it, I will not get hit at the individual level for it. But if I see only the individual level, the egotistic level, for doing it, I must get hit. So we place the two ideas not on the same level, but one above the other. We'll have the E level up there, and we'll have the H level there, below it. And your choice is whether you're going to go up to the universal or down to the individual. Every time you make a decision in favour of yourself as an individual, which means you have conceptualised yourself as an individual power, will, over against other individuals, then you will be in trouble. Because at the individual level, there is this cannonball mechanics of individuated forms. And you start telling them, for that purpose, you have tuned yourself to the universe. You will then begin to transform. No reason at all why you shouldn't for a time place your H with the bar, the crossbar, right on the borderline, so that you can see the universal up there and make your individual application down there. The universal is the authority for everything that appears within it. Those who see the universal become aware of it, and the universal will pass through the information from the absolute about the new design of refrigerators for next year. But if the individual stretches himself as a headman over against others and fights for himself, then he cannot get the information about next year's design. So in terms of efficiency only, it is better to be universal rather than individual. Let's just revert to the semantic a moment. If we say that production of change in conformity with the will is the meaning of magic, we can be a little more precise and say that some magicians don't know they're magicians. They're functioning blindly. They are wills. And changes are being produced. But they are not reflective and they don't really know what they're doing. And consequently, they are not efficient magicians at all. They are genuinely lacking magic. That is what happens at the Q level. At the K level, you find a terrific amount of literature read about magic. Because the K level is the intellectual level that feels its deficiency in power. So it's at the intellectual level that we find this profound interest in magic of the lower kind, black man, and magic of the upper kind, the headman level. The fact that this great mass of left-wingers, intellectuals, are interested in art, only the measure of their lack of it. So inside an individual, if it's found that there is a tendency, I'm seeing a book called Black Magic, How to Do It, to grab it and rush off into a corner and start reading it. Know immediately that that impulse is necessarily deficient. Because it actually thinks there's something outside itself that could give it the information it needs to make those magical changes. There's a colossal amount of literature published in America on scientific prayer, on magical prayer, and so on. It is sold to the K level. If the cover is lurid enough, it's sold to the lower K level where the legs just go into the Q zone. If the cover is abstract enough, it goes a bit higher up in the K level. So the head level doesn't bother about such literature because he knows sense that he is a will, and that everything he does by will. But the top level A-man is aware that there is a universal, and that there must be conformity of the individual will to the universal will if there is to be efficiency. So if I don't know whether you've read that horrible book, Gangrene, that was banned, seized by the French police, about the Algerian atrocities. The introduction by Peter Benenson is very good, because he doesn't argue sentimentally against tortures. He argues on the ground of efficiency. He says if you torture men, you make the men who are being tortured, morally you're superior. And they feel superior, and then they won't tell you what you want to know. So he has not sentimental, but an efficient reason for being against torture. If you find a book and read it, particularly the introduction, you will enjoy that part of it. It's also about police practice, both British and French. It could be applied to all countries. When we climb up then to the K level, we find rationalizing about magic, but we don't get any performance until at the H level the headman acts by will. But he's not so much concerned with rituals and doing certainly one card, because those things in general belong in the K level. Now they can be used as a support even by a headman, but he never falls into believing that they are efficacious. So if he draws a circle on the cross, he knows it's because he has drawn it. So if we find Montgomery with a photograph of Rommel in his tent in Africa, and he's studying that face and looking for signs of character and trying to read Rommel's character, he doesn't believe that Rommel's character is in the photograph and that the photograph is magical. He believes that if he focuses on that photograph and thinks about Rommel and feels about Rommel, something about Rommel will get into him, because he knows there is a field far. And he demonstrates his superiority and efficiency in that way. So the individual magician fighting his own cause is the black magician. And there are various levels within the H level of the individual black magician on the left hand path. The left hand path means it's not universal, it's individual for individual ends. But those headmen who stick their horns over the border into the universal level realize that the biggest magic won't work if it is merely individual. It's got to be made universal. In other words, you'll find a man who wants to make a major change in the country, like Hitler. Now, he is working like a headman. He's working by will, and he believed in magic, and he had an advisor, astrologer, and so on. But he did not wish to subordinate himself to the universal. He wanted to make the evolution of the earth proceed in a definite manner with Germany as the center. Now, because of certain laws to do with the precipitation of the earth from the very beginning, Germany cannot be such a centre. He should have gone to England to be such a centre. But he didn't go there because he was too far. He went from Austria to Germany. That was a miscalculation. He knew that certain facts of geopolitics were against it. But he didn't like what was against it, because it was against his individual will. So he cut off all the geopolitical facts that didn't subserve his thousand-year Reich. And in the act of suppressing them, of cutting them off from his consciousness, he became unaware of essential data, and thereby became inefficient. Now, when we climb up to this level of realizing there is a universal scheme, and that if we want the universal efficiency, we will have to find out what that scheme is, and then agree with it in the same way that the universal agrees with the absolute, then we can say we cannot fail. Now you notice that Montgomery was very Taoistic, because he said, I will not fight until I am certain that I will win. You didn't fight when the other people were ready to fight. You just waited and waited and waited for the critical moment. And so some people thought almost he wasn't a good militarist, because he just didn't fight all the time. That's true, regardless. He waited. You remember in War and Peace, the waiting game that the Russians played, and they did nap. And you may remember the arguments there, that this isn't militarism, this isn't fighting, this is waiting. Well, the universal strategist who defeated Napoleon, tapping his fingers on the table, said, patience and time, patience and time. Patience meant to say that there is an essence, which is in every point, situation, cross. And the essence of that fact, that thought, is patience. In each moment, something can be done, essentially, and nothing else. To do that thing in that moment is to be efficient and to be immediate. But to try to do something else is to disregard time. Because patience is that as foot, that's the same as foot. Put your foot down. And each time you put your foot on a gross fact, and you traverse space from moment to moment to concrete situations, and in each situation there is an essential thing which can be done, and you put your foot on it, and that's patience. Whereas impatience is to make a long leg like that, which goes right over the edge of the precipice, and then when you put it down, it goes down. When we are considering this fact, if we ally ourselves with the universal, and we examine it very carefully, we will find that there are certain things that cannot be done. 4 years ago, I received a letter asking me to reply to it immediately. I didn't reply. This week, I replied to it. Now, the person receiving it will be surprised, but it was premature to reply there. And if I had replied, I would have been in trouble, because it came from a gentleman of the K level, who is in jail for political activities in Germany. Now, I don't agree with his political activities, and I don't agree with his time consciousness, because I don't agree at all with what he calls the essential process. He says that revolution by application of force is the only way of overthrowing the headman. The fact is, they can only be overthrown from above. Anybody who starts a revolution at the Q level will get a black eye. If you start one at the K level, you'll get a row in the office. If you start one at the head level, you will probably be chased out to Whitehall. And if you try to start one at the universal level, you'll suddenly find yourself roped in and used as part of the merry-go-round. What we have to do is realize this. When Christ says, what the Father does, the absolute, I, the magnificent self, do also. And the Father gives without measure, that is without counting, this is to do with this divine system. And it comes in without measure because it is continuous. Absolute reality is not made of parts, and therefore there is no counting in it. And therefore it gives itself without measure. But as soon as this rotation is considered and identified with, counting begins where that absolute is considered to be internal to that rotation. So the rotation is the ground of the counting. When it comes inside now, the universal doesn't count it. But the absolute coming within the sphere reverberates within the sphere, and those reverberations within it cut it into minute portions, which are dominions, which are houses, and ultimately places, pyloises, little spiritual dwellings, of which Christ says, every man has his own place, he goes to it, and his work follows. The absolute energy goes in, into the universal, is differentiated within the universal, only actually there's no discrete particle absolutely separated. There are merely vibrations of the absolute which, when identified with, appear to be discrete. And so there are different speeds relatively from the perimeter, the E level, up to the H level, and change of frequency through the H level, change of frequency through the K level, change of frequency to the Q level. Each frequency getting slower, longer way, duller, more gross, more inertic, more ignorant. I'm going to turn now to a very learned paper by Mr. Bligh here, which is very, very good. He doesn't call it a question because it is a series of comments on ideas of the absolute. And they're very well thought out, so we'll discuss them a little. He says, the idea of impulses as centres of circles, the number of which extends to infinity, leads us into contradiction, because we cannot have an infinite number. Now, an infinite number, by the use of the indefinite article, an infinite number, is one infinite number. The contradiction here is not in the idea of the impulses as centres of circles. It is in the use of the expression we, finite being, cannot have, finitely possess, an infinite, that is non-finite, number. When we're formulating ideas in this manner, we have to be tremendously careful. Let's take out those disqualifying words. The idea of impulses as centres of circles, the number of which extends to infinity, leads into contradiction. I've left us out. We're not contradiction. Leads into contradiction. Contradiction means contra same. There is some opposition. And of course there is. If we postulate a lot of circles and we cover infinite space with them, we have introduced contradiction. The contradiction is the same, the diction of each one of these points, against the others. It is not more than that. The contradiction is always an actual contradiction of motions from centres. If we leave out we and so on and possess and we have, then the idea reduces to this fact that the consideration of centres of impulse leads to contradiction. It's the real substance of that particular idea. When you formulate an idea like this, it is evidence of a large amount of work at the K level, which is leading at the moment you see the paradox to the H level. Now remember, the paradox is beyond this K level. The H man is essentially paradoxical. A certain very large religious organization bases itself on Aristotelian logic. We will translate Aristotle as meaning death to the Aristotle. And because the logic of Aristotle is not paradoxical, it says A equals A, and not A is not A, that is not paradoxical at all. They cannot handle a paradoxical situation. At the K level, the situation is always A, not A. A thing is either A or not A. But every being itself is and is not, because it is becoming. And becoming is a word that resolves the difference between being and non-being. What are we? We are becoming. We are not babies and we're not yet old men. We are becoming between babies and old men. So we cannot say either I'm a baby or not, or I'm an old man or not, despite the difference. We can only say I'm becoming. But becoming means being non-being, simultaneously. So the fact of my being, becoming, is already paradoxical, which places it above the K-level. So to climb into initiative power, we have to become paradoxical. We must get over this reasoned statement saying, well, you can't do that there here, because A is A and not A is not A. This kind of statement has been used by people the Aristotelian persuasion very often, a long time ago,
in the Renaissance, a man looked through a telescope he just made and rushed off and said, I have seen spots on the sun. And the learned divine picked up a copy of Aristotle's works and said, I'm sorry, you're mistaken, Aristotle doesn't mention them. Now, that kind of blockage of truth must arise from a non-paradoxical system. A non-paradoxical system is presenting one side of a coin and denying that the other side of the coin has anything to do with the coin. So it's all heads all the way through. I remember once meeting a very fun little fellow who said that he had split a pound note with a razor blade and passed them. And I said, but how did you manage to pass them when they were only printed on one side? And he hadn't thought of it. So he said, well, as a matter of fact, the ink soaks through from both sides, and if you cut very carefully, you've got 2 pound notes printed on both sides. He hadn't noticed the mechanical deficiency of the printing method. Now, the second one here says, these circles would also mean that counting would be possible in the absolute, which is also contradictory. Now again, this is a very, very good perception. It's back to prediction. Remember when we look at the sea flat, we cannot count the sea. But if the wind blows on it and makes ripples, we can count the ripples. We're still not counting the sea, we're counting the ripples. When we think about the infinite, by definition of the infinite, it is not thin. And consequently, it cannot be counted. But there's nothing at all against us counting ripple, crests, or troughs within an infinite motion. We can't help it, no. If we can't help it, there's nothing against it. The Bhagavad Gita says, why grieve for the inevitable? Three, the absolute is non-dual and therefore not particular. Therefore counting is impossible. This again is answered by this fact. We can count crests and troughs of motions without in fact being able to count absolute motions. Fourth one, since one circle is surrounded by six others, the absolute would exist. Again, this is a paradox. All the existence, which means existere out of six, runs right through, but when we are talking about the circles, we are not talking about the absolute. This frame of reference. We're talking about the actualizing circles. So the absolute does not exist, but it's the very ground of it. Philosophers have dreadful difficulty with this fact of the absolute, because if they use the word exist on it, the scientists become very annoyed and prove that it can't. Whereas it is only action that exists. If we try to think of these circles as non-rotating, we are confused by those that are rotations. This is actually a statement about a psychological difficulty of thinking about circles non-rotating and others rotating. Remember that in fact the circle doesn't rotate at all. If you put your mind on it, it will tend to go round it. And if you're not careful, it will go round a lot of them. Because the psyche gets bored, literally. It bores hold of itself by going over and over the same stimulus. It loses interest, and therefore it skips off onto another circle. Now, there are a lot more of these ideas, which are very well thought out, but careful examination of them will illustrate that the removal of a certain word here and there will, in fact, resolve the problem by making a paradoxical statement, including the two horns of the dilemma. This is a good one here. The absolute before creation is still and waiting, a state of no motion. An act of will or spontaneity creates the universe. Now, remember what we said about the word static. We cannot use the word static of the absolute, and we cannot use the word still of the absolute, because still and static are derived from sense percepts of finite. and they're only relative. If a motion goes round and round and round, it constitutes, relative to another one, the distance between which does not change, a still zone. And that stillness has nothing to do with the absolute. The absolute is not still. Still refers necessarily to this ST function. As soon as you get STL, you know that you are dealing with something tied up and fixed. And the absolute shock is the...
Yes, I've got a look from you.
Yes. Well, would you like to do a little exercise in those? And look through them, and I'll look through them. There's a lot of them here. And we will compare notes about the results of the examination, shall we, on another occasion. I just want to look at a question here. But it's rather important. Put that. An individual man is understood as spirit, investing itself with a vehicle of experience, which vehicle has engrammed on it the experience of his ancestors. An individual who appears to be stressed on certain functions, an individual also appears to be stressed on certain functions, and he can be referred to as a type. Can we discuss the type activity in relation to his other manifestations and possibilities, as it is observed that this activity is the strongest enemy, the least easily observed, only in oneself, and therefore the most difficult to work against? Can type be equated with Gurdjieff's idea of essence? We'll dismiss the last part immediately. Type cannot be equated with Gurdjieff's idea of essence, because type here is form, and as defined, is the form of an individual man. You must assert both of a pair of opposites to the absolute, and therefore, when we are considering differentiating factors, namely individuation factors, we are not talking about the absolute, and therefore we're not actually talking about spirit, which is the absolute. We're talking about vehicles of spirit. Now, each vehicle, we'll say each human vehicle for this purpose, has engrammed on it the experiences of his ancestors. This we know because butterflies beget butterflies and humans beget humans. The form in the egg expresses itself, and thereby we know the continuity that we mean by heredity. An individual who appears to be stressed on certain functions can be referred to as a type. Now, by type, obviously, we're talking about a concept which is very closely related to topos, place. Now, when Christ says, every man has his own place and goes into it, he's saying that there is a topos, a place, and that the form in that place is typical. In other words, every place in our diagram of the infinite impulsation is peculiarly itself, and the vibrations initiated in that place are the characterizing or individuating factors which separate it from the others. All separation is only actual, and is an actualizing of individuating or formal factors. Form is action. And if you act in A manner, then you will be differentiated from a being acting in B manner. So, now, this type activity is the strongest enemy. We can see that it must be so immediately. As soon as we consider that type activity is the activity of the place. Supposing we take a human being, we trace him back, and we discover that he came from an egg. And that egg was resident in a body, maybe the mother, and was impregnated by another one from a man, and at least you were body. Now, all bodies occupy spaces and demark spaces. Each body is a form in a place. It's really a function of a place. So that to be born and to be carried is to be carried in a place, a topos. And all the places through which that being goes are conditioning factors on the form born. So, in the same way, we are carried in our mothers, we are carried on earth, not on Saturn or Venus, on earth. And the earth has a certain distance from the sun, a certain orbit, a certain length of year, and exposes all the forms on the earth to certain cosmic forces. Again, the earth is in a place, and there are type bands on the earth. Thus, the life on the equator is typified by its topical or place values. Its form value and its place value can be equated. So a person born in Liverpool is not born in Wigan or Rio de Janeiro or something. Wherever it is born, it is subjected to definite forces which intersect at that place. So every place has its own formal vibration. And a being in that place is subjected to it, retains the memory of that to which it has been subjected, and therefore becomes progressively characterized by the places in which it is resident. Now it's obvious, certainly, to be interior to a being is very much to be placed. We are placed on the earth, in the solar system. The solar system is in a vastly larger system, and we are conditioned by these forces, and the more so, the less we understand them. This fact of the big universal place has conditioned all the subspaces within it. There is no escape from that without the recognition of what it means to be placed, to be in a topos and to be typis, to be formed by place. If we are aware of this fact, we can see what it means that place is the strongest enemy. Time is the strongest enemy. The form in a given place is the enemy. You will notice that it's a characteristic delivery in every town in the country and in every country in the world. There's a characteristic speech, a characteristic vocabulary, and the vocabulary conditions the people who use it, conditions their thoughts. You know that in some of the primitive languages they have no vocabulary for technical subjects that we find in the West, and therefore they cannot begin to think about the kind of problems that are dealt with by the West. Mind. So, when we are exposed to a place, we're exposed to a variety of influences, social, and so on, particularly by vocabulary influences from tradition, and those things fill the mind with form, so the form is just the measure of the place. This is the TP function. Again, we said the PT, put, patience, and the T would be, it's the same thing. You put, that's the foot, foundation, and what you put down is the place. And wherever you put your foot, you will be conditioned by it. This is why Christ says, when a man marries a woman, they shall become one flesh. Not they'll be fond of each other, they shall become one flesh. Because when he puts his energies into that place, and you recognize the root again, TPP, yeah. In fact, he is introducing spatially derived determinants into this other being, and receiving such determinants into himself. So St. Paul says, if you knew what you received when you were giving in that relation, you would be careful about the kind of relation into which you enter. Because you are bound to receive. One fellow, about a year ago it will be, roughly, was rather shocked to discover that all his previous girlfriends were engrammed on his brain, and that he had a lot of mannerisms, and even his chemistry had changed. And when it was demonstrated to him, he was still carrying about with him what he had acquired from these girls. He was horrified. Because he had acquired, this was a horrifying thing to him, the vocabularies of their boyfriends. Now the Q motive in him didn't like it. In talking to these various girls and being enamored of them for long enough, He had been conditioned by the boys, who had already conditioned the girls. So he was not, in effect, simply acting on the girl and receiving nothing. He was being imposed on by boys, as well as imposing on the girl, and this he didn't like. He thought he would give it up. Now, the enemy, of course, the strongest enemy, is the most difficult to work against. How are we going to work against this fact that topos, place, and type, form, are inextricably related? The answer is by non-identification with form, with place. A fellow who's born in the Whitechapel Road, and who worries about it, identified with it, will have trouble about certain concepts related to it. Now, if he wants to break out of that type behaviour, he must break out of the memory of the place. Now, he can only do this by studying more places. He can't eliminate Whitechapel from himself. That's a place it's hard to eliminate. So, the only thing to do with it is to discover the environs, to do a bit of local history around it, and in so doing to extend the concept. Gradually you can cover London, and then you can cover England, and eventually cover the world. The only way you can escape the domination of one place is by the extension of that attention beyond the limits of the conditioning place, until you identify not with the place in which you were born, brought up, dragged up, pushed up, or whatever, but you're going to go out beyond the little local earth setting, beyond the solar system, beyond the sidereal system, and finally to realize that the universe itself is a precipitate of the absolute, and that you can identify with the universal, and that will contain all these other places, and you will then have become of universal form in having become aware of universal place. Then when you remember that the universe is a precipitate of the absolute, you can then abandon the identification with the universal and identify with the absolute. The universal won't disappear on that account. It'll still be there with all the other spheres. But now their internal relations will be comprehended simultaneously. So we can admit that type is a very great enemy, but type is like place, reducible to another word that everybody thinks is too simple, inertia. The real enemy is inertia and nothing else. Inertia means in work, affirmation. See? The amount of work or energy involved, there's the work, the ad. If you put a G there, you'll recognize the egg. If you put a K there, you'll recognize the intellectual attitude to work, which is irksome. Yeah is affirmation. See? Work in. Every finite is simply an energy working in and keeping itself in. That's the Saturnine value again. Saturn is dominating Jupiter, where there is inertia. Now, inertia has a definite value. The absolute posits primary inertia, matter, the matrix of all things, cues it and emerges through it again in reflexive self-conscious being. If, instead of worrying about type and place, we turn them all into the fact of work, we can still remember that place is form, and form is place, and that you have never seen a place that wasn't characterized by form, and you've never seen a form that wasn't in a place, and that what you think or feel about forms is largely conditioned by their spatial relations with other forms. So we make the equation here that all problems, whatever, are problems of inertia. And the way to conquer that is, as we said, transcending space, place. place, transcending form. That wasn't a deliberate mistake. Transcending place, we can't transcend space. Transcending place is the same thing as breaking inertias of identification. Remember, all that is can never cease to be. But what we hold as central to our consciousness determines. Where the treasure is, there is the heart also. The heart is the center. And it is that universal, you see the H-E, heart, which is a little taller again. And the center is that hole that cannot be filled by the motion. There is the art, the tor, and in the middle is the head, which is the spirit. And that is the heart. Where the heart is, there is the treasure. And the treasure is the Torah sure. It implies that your security is in it. If you then place as central to your consciousness any level, Q, K, H, or whatever it is, or any particular you automatically make it a heart. And when you make it into a heart, energies flow to it and away from it, just like the blood goes to and from the heart. The whole of your life is then conditioned by that concept with which you have identified. So to escape all these types, these places, these inertias, is the same thing as continuously practicing non-identification. In the Bhagavad Gita it says, worship is continual remembrance. Now to remember is to make again a member. We want to become again a member of the universal to gain our identification with the absolute. We must make ourselves a member of the universal. Because only by becoming universal can the individual level be transcended. And only when the universal has been gained can we do an absolute will.